On this episode of The Flittish Show, number 42, I talk about, well, there's a Brenda Starr update, and then I talk about Rousseau. I read a passage from Rousseau's The Confessions, and then I talk about the Gospel according to Judas, and I finish off with the resurrection. Happy Easter. This and more. The Flittish Show, starring Kenty and Jose. Welcome to the Flittish Show. That's my tab for my diet. Tab, do I need a diet? It's Easter Sunday, and John and I just got back from his sister's house. They hosted the Easter dinner this year. We do Thanksgiving and Memorial Day picnics, and she does Christmas and Easter. She made a ham. I made chicken croquettes. Woohoo! Everybody loves the chicken croquettes. And let's see, what else did we have? We had asparagus and all sorts of wonderful things, roasted vegetables. So, yes, I'm Kenty, and you're listening to The Flittish Show. Jose is in the other room taking a nap. He was in here last week and the week before taking a nap. But he is in the other room taking a nap with Johnny. And let's see here. You can reach me at 206-339-JOSE and leave me a voice message. Just let me know I can use it on the air, and I will. And you can reach me on email at kenty@theflatishow.com. If you come and visit my webpage, theflatishow.com, www.theflatishow.com, you can look through there, see some of my original music, and find the podcast. And I have an Amazon store there with some stuff that I like, that I recommend, John Waters movies and stuff like that. Okay, so let's start the show. First off, sometimes I talk about other podcasts, and there's a new podcast I heard the other day, which I really liked. It's hosted by Ninja, and it's called Hot Fossils and Rebel Matters. I found it on qpotter.org, and I'm going to play their promo right now.
Hi, I'm Ninja, the host of the Hot Fossils and Rebel Matter show. I give you 15, give or take, minutes of fun-filled observations, commentary, reviews, performance pieces, and sometimes interviews. Sometimes serious, sometimes not, sometimes hot. I invite you to try it out. That's the Hot Fossils and Rebel Matter show at hotfrm.blogmatrix.com. I'm also listed on www.qpotter.org. Give it a try. I'd love to spend some time with you.
So what I really liked about their show, they started talking about Go Ask Alice the book, and they played Jefferson Airplane's song, Alice, the White Rabbit. And I love that song. Now, I make fun of it. Ooh, I'm yawning. That's so rude. But this is podcasting, and this is reality, baby. I'm not like those television radio personalities on Clear Channel. Fuck that. Anyway, my brain, it's like a train off its track. So yeah, Hot Fossils and Rebel Matters, go listen to it. I think I love their show. I love what they talk about. And tab for my diet. Okay, and I also received a voice message from Joe G. And I'm going to play that right now.
Hello, Ken. This is Joe G. from Beppe Podcast at beppe.lipson.com, which means that you can use this message on your show. I wanted to comment on two shows. One is the last one, show number 41, about the whiskey and the alcohol. I just want to say that if I sipped that much alcohol on my show, I would have been drunk. I was amazed that you weren't slurring your speech by the end of the show. I also, though, I have to say that one of my favorite shows was show number 40. I mean, where else can you hear about the career of Linda Carter, hear ukulele music, and also learn about irritable bowel syndrome, but on your show? It's wonderful. I mean, I can't even come up with that kind of mix of subject matter for my own podcast. So it was a bravo performance. Okay, thank you. I'm glad I can call you. This is fun. Okay, have fun. And thank you so much for mentioning the show, Beppe Podcast, on your own show. I really appreciate it. I have not done the same to you, unfortunately. But I really appreciate it and know that I'm listening every week. I wait for your show, along with a few others, of course. Okay, keep podcasting. Bye-bye.
First thing, Joe G., thank you for phoning. That's really nice to hear from you. The sipping all that liquor was very, very small bit of liquor. I just took maybe a teaspoonful of each of them and swirled it around my mouth and let it, you know, probably even less than a teaspoon, because I put it into a little shot glass to smell it, right? And then I took a little sip and poured the rest out. And I just let it, you know, get into my nose and my throat and get the taste and describe it as I did. So it wasn't really a lot of liquor. I wasn't drinking tons and tons of liquor. I had the drink in the beginning. I did make one. I did make it with a little bit of scotch whiskey and the water. But I didn't drink at all. And it was just enough so I could say, yes, I did make a whiskey and soda for the opening. Because it was a whiskey show, and instead of the tab, I got the had the whiskey with water. Which leads me to, I have had a couple alcoholic episodes, or alcohol-based episodes. Back in December, I guess it was, I did a gin martini episode, the Martinis Until the End of Time, which I think is one of my best podcasts. And I made this show. It was actually a recommendation, not a recommendation, but something that podcaster Randy had told me about. I forget what it was we were emailing about, but oh yeah, he emailed me about something I had mentioned on the show previously, which is a vodka martini called the Bohème, where you put a key in there with the olive as the hold the olive, because the key represents the key that's lost that brings Rodolfo and Mimi together in the beginning of La Boheme. I was going to say you could put a candle on the side too, because she has a little candle that goes out. But that would probably be dangerous to have next to like volatile liquid like vodka. So he said he liked gin martinis better. So I really prefer gin myself. The only reason why I said vodka is because you can really freeze vodka and get it really cold, because in the opera La Boheme, Mimi's tiny hand is frozen. So I'm repeating myself, but for those who didn't hear that show, that's basically what brought me to do the martinis Until the End of Time. So I talk about gin and vermouth and wormwood, and ends up do a Wikipedia round robin, and I end up at the end of time. So anyway, I did the whiskey show, and this is the whiskey show was last week. But in between this, before the whiskey show was available, I listened to the two guys, and this is what I heard.
Well, today, I don't know why, I re-listened. I'm telling you, that listener Ken has a really good show.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why it appeals to me so much. He's very cerebral, which I ordinarily am not. You know what I mean? He's very, he likes the music and the books and the, you know, he's very up here, that guy, that listener Ken.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not. I'm just a big dumb jackass most of the time. For some reason, though, his show really appeals to me. And I told you before, his martini show.
Have some.
Was really, really good.
Have some, yeah.
And it really made me want one really bad.
Have some.
So today.
Have some.
Been drinking.
Have some.
Listener Ken martinis.
Have some. Have some. Have some. Have some. How many?
Got one right there.
Yeah. How many? Have some.
I'm not sure.
Have some. Have you lost count?
They're little.
Have some.
Yeah.
Have some.
They're not very big.
Have some. You were very funny when I have some first got here, and then something happened.
What happened?
You got a little mean.
So anyway, I am now
have some
more inebriated than usual, and I blame listener Ken. That was the point of my initial tirade.
Have some.
Because I re-listened to his martini show, because he and I have been corresponding, and he's doing a show about whiskey this weekend.
Have some. Oh, no.
And as you know, I am very partial to the scotch.
Mm-hmm. Have some.
So he was, we had been chatting back and forth about, you know, scotch whiskey and Canadian whiskey and Irish whiskey, because he's doing a show, and I'm sure it'll be very well researched and very interesting, and it will appeal to me, and I will buy a bunch and drink it.
Good. Have some.
But for now, the gin martini.
Have some. Have some. Have some. Have some.
I think I will.
Have some.
Say something interesting, Andy.
I will not. Ever. Have some.
Now, to me, he's blaming me for his drunkenness, right? For all those martinis he's drinking. And you can clearly hear Andy goading him on throughout the podcast. Have another. Have another. Have another. You know, it's clear to me that it's Andy who is, you know, forcing the liquor down Randy's throat. So, I don't know about those two guys, but, you know, I think I'm off the hook. So, maybe I have to put warnings in my podcast that they contain alcohol, which I did, actually. I did warn you. It contains alcohol. And if you're an alcoholic, I don't want you listening to it, because, you know what? I'm not an enabler, and I'm not going to be responsible for you falling off the wagon. You get me, Sarita? So, let's see. Is there anything else? Oh, yes. I would like to conclude. Let me conclude about the Seagram 7. Okay, the whiskey show. There is a great whiskey, which I didn't taste last week, but I have tasted this week. I was able to. And it's called Seagram's VO Gold Canadian Whiskey Blend. It's an 8-year-old whiskey, signature blend, and it was affordable. It was really delicious. Now, I know these older scotches taste, you know, awful, but I think it's because the scotch is put into aged and charred barrels. That's where it gets the smokiness. Whereas whiskey is in just a regular oak cask. Well, this 8-year-old whiskey is very good. It's smooth. It's darker. It's amber, but it's much darker, and it just, I have some right here. It's so good. It smells good. I also picked up to try, because I really never had it, was cognac. And there's a brand called Landy Cognac. It's made in France. Now, the bottle, I really bought it for the bottle. The bottle is really cool. And I also bought it because it was cheap. It was only $16.99. But it's sort of like the I Dream of Jeannie bottle. And it has a cork for the top. So I'm going to keep the bottle when the cognac's done. But the cognac has a really nice odor, and it is made from wine. It's made from grape wine. And I made a sidecar with it, which was really delicious. And I'm going to keep it around, because I'm not going to drink it all. This is something you sip. You use small amounts of it. It is quite alcoholic in content. But I'm going to use it for ice creams and stuff like that. I can light it, and or Cherry's Jubilee. So, with this said, I want to say this. Frapper Map. Come visit my Frapper Map and sign up, please. Sign my Frapper Map. I have 12 people and I love all 12 of you. Robert was the last one, I think, to sign up. Robert of Phoenix. I hope you're still listening. And I hope all my listeners who are on the Frapper Map are listening. But if you're new to the show and you're inclined, go to my Frapper Map. I believe I have the link in my show notes. I'm certain I do. And if you come to the podcast, yes, I do. I have links to my show notes. So if you go to my webpage, www.theflatedshow.com, click on the podcast link. It's the fourth hole of the recorder on that page. Go in and you can see where my shows are listed. You can click on the link to you can click on the link. I'm laughing because there's a cat looking at me, and I have not mentioned this cat yet, but I will after I'm done here. So Frapper Map, Frapper Map, Frapper me, Frapper me. I want more people to Frapper me. I want to know who my. I mean, there are shows who are newer than me, and they have like 500. You know, people on their damn Frapper Map. Of course, I don't talk about the Frapper Map that much. And I guess I really don't want to be like a size queen, you know, have meaning a size queen for the number of listeners I have. Because there are some shows which have thousands and thousands of downloads. And they're very good, of course, you know. I don't know. I don't know what to say. I guess I'm never going to have thousands of listeners, but, you know, the listeners I do have, can you please just sign my fucking Frapper Map so I know who you are, Sharita? Okay. Also, Podcast Alley. If you can just throw me a fucking bone, vote for me once or twice. I mean, you know, I'm never going to be number one in the audio blogs, but, you know, I could get up there a little bit. I could at least be 200, you know, instead of 1,500 or whatever it is. And I've had people vote for me. So if you could just vote for me on Podcast Alley, that would be really nice if you're into that. I know it's okay if you don't, I suppose. But please, please, please. So I guess I'm begging. I'm begging. Beggars can't be choosers. Please vote for me. Tell your friends if you like the Flatus Show. And all my new listeners, I'm so happy to have you. And the Hawaiian music guide, Pico and his wife, and podcaster Randy and Big C and Beppe and Mandrake Society Radio, JW Richard and Robert. Am I forgetting anybody? See, I can't remember. It's in my brain. I have to write them all down. But if you put yourself on the Frapper Map, I could know who you are. And I'm probably missing somebody, so, and I really apologize. But my brain is a 41-year-old brain. I have hemorrhoids, and I'm overstuffed, and I'm drinking Tab. Isn't it time for Tab? Cold, refreshing Tab? I think so. On with the show. Lash! That's Brenda Starr you hear, finishing up her scoop just for you. Brenda Starr. Okay, last time I talked about Brenda Starr, she was interviewing Senator Folsom, and we learned that the Senator Folsom, Ruck, and Tuna were in prison. Tuna was a great cook, got favors, and was beat up because of these favors. However, Ruck came to his rescue. In return, Tuna was to do Ruck's bidding. When they got out of jail, Ruck dreamed up a scam that involved bringing Chihuahuas, importing Chihuahuas into the country that were stuffed with drugs. So after getting the drugs out of the dogs, that they were pooped out, they sold them and made a lot of money, and Ruck put his money into a restaurant and had Tuna cook for him, saying that, you know, that Ruck was doing the cooking, was really Tuna, and Folsom became a senator. So with these dogs, they bred them and sold them to rich people, making more money. So Brenda returns to the office after the interview and tells her editor what has been going on. And while this is happening, there is a fire that has broke out in Frank Folsom's office. This is on the news. And then he is presumed dead. This time, Brenda prepares to go to the Celebrity Chef Ball, where it's a celebrity cook-off, and they're raising money to help Chihuahuas. And, of course, Ruck is selling his biography. And leaves. So she gets ready, leaves her apartment, and leaves Rico, which is Tuna's nephew, waiting for the babysitter, her next-door neighbor. At the chef's ball, there's a bunch of chit-chat, and Brenda's tasting the food and thinks it's wonderful. And she wonders how Rock could cook if Tuna is dead. So she snoops around and finds out back that Tuna is alive and he's chained in Rock's trailer cooking. And we find out that Rock set the blaze to make it look like Tuna was dead and then gave him a choice to either cook for him or die. So Tuna chose to cook for him because, you know, he wanted to live. Meanwhile, Rico leaves the apartment because he's tired of waiting and takes Patch, Brenda's dog, with him. And they end up at the Chihuahua place. And he says, here's some friends, Patch. So Brenda, meanwhile, is trying to phone the police. And her cell phone battery is dead. And the babysitter calls Hank, the editor, and tells her that the boy has left, is gone. So Hank's trying to get in touch with Brenda. She can't because Brenda's cell phone is dead. So Brenda returns to the ball, and Rock during this time keeps on asking Gabby Van Slender where Brenda is, and she's saying, I don't know, but you're making me jealous. So he sees Brenda, grabs her, and starts dancing with her, and then whispers into her ear, I've got a knife, Brenda. And I know what to do with it. And that's where we're at. Rousseau, The Confessions. I want to read a passage from Rousseau's The Confessions. Which this passage, when I read it for the first time when I was in college, it was a course called Foundations of History. It was an overall course. It wasn't philosophy. It was a little bit of everything. The course name was Intellectual Heritage. Because the name of the course was very important for you to understand. Anyway, it was a Western thought. It was a course in Western thought, in science and philosophy and all sorts of things. I'll try to remember the name of it because it's a good name. But anyway, this particular passage I read and I was like, I just loved it. It was so close. I mean, it brought Rousseau. This to me made me realize that people are really the same from then to now. And Rousseau was in the 18th century, I believe. I should get the book. I'm so unprepared here. This podcasting business, you know, I'm a one-man band, and I want to do this stuff. Oh, yeah, he died. Oh, in 1766, he was 54, and he began work on the Confessions, okay? So that's where we're at, 18th century. So I'm going to read these two different translations, and this is to show you, to illustrate how important a translation is, especially for English speakers who rarely learn another language. So the original is in French, okay? So the Gutenberg Library, which is online, you can get some public domain, a lot of public domain stuff. But this is from the Gutenberg Library, and this is not what I had originally read. At length, and this is pertaining to Madame de Vercellis, a woman he was living with as in service at one point. At length we lost her. I saw her expire. She had lived like a woman of sense and virtue. Her death was that of a philosopher. I can truly say she rendered the Catholic religion amiable to me by the serenity with which she fulfilled its dictates, without any mixture of negligence or affectation. She was naturally serious, but towards the end of her illness she possessed a kind of gaiety, too regular to be assumed, which served as a counterpoise to the melancholy of her situation. She only kept her bed 2 days, continuing to discourse cheerfully with those about her to the very last. Okay, that's from the Gutenberg Library. This is from an anonymous translation privately printed in 1904. At length we lost her. I saw her die. Her life had been the life of a woman of talent and intelligence. Her death was that of a philosopher. I can say that she inspired me with a feeling of esteem for the Catholic religion by the cheerfulness of soul with which she fulfilled its instructions, without carelessness and without affectation. She was naturally of a serious disposition. Towards the end of her illness, she assumed a kind of gaiety which was too regular to be unreal, and which was only a counterpoise to her melancholy condition and was a gift of reason. She only kept her bed the two last days, and continued to converse quietly with everybody to the end. At last, speaking no more, and already in the agonies of death, she broke wind loudly. "Good," she said, turning round. "A woman who can fart is not dead." These were the last words she uttered. Notice between these two how the first translator, you know, chooses English words which, you know, give this sense of, I don't know, it's kind of dullness. I mean, she makes her seem, I think, a Catholic. A priest probably, you know, translated the first one, makes it seem very serious. But the second one is much more, you know, a fart. I mean, the first translator just forgot or decided, oh, that's not important, and it is important. So what I'm trying to say here is, yeah, if you're reading things in translation and really basing any kind of faith or thought on it, make sure, if you can, possibly, make sure it is the best translation. And better yet, learn the language that it is written in, because that's really the only way we're going to know. Now, at the same time, it's kind of silly, because I don't think we're going to learn, Americans are going to learn, French or, you know, all these other languages to read the original in, which is sad to me, because I'd love to know that, but I know I can't do it. My brain can't do it. Even if I learned French, would I be able to understand all of the nuances of 18th century French? No, I don't think so. So, in my gut, I feel that the second translation is the true translation of this passage of this work, and because it seems to me more aligned with what I believe Rousseau was trying to convey. But you wonder it just makes me angry that first translator just left out things, changed words. Some of it's there, and a lot of it's not, and the whole character of it is gone. And it puts the Catholic religion as being the focus, and the second one is not. It's more just the way things are, and that is the way things are. So there you go. Whenever life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem sad or tough, and people are useless or obnoxious or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving, revolving at 900 miles an hour, and orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned, a sun that is the source of all our power. Now the sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving a million miles a day in a outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 million stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 60,000 light years thick, but out of us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy itself is one of Millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe. The universe itself keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, the speed of light, you know. 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, 'cause there's a bugger all down here on Earth. The Gospel of Judas. This past week, National Geographic both released the book version of the Gospel of Judas, lost for 1,600 years, as well as had that television special, which I didn't see because I don't have a National Geographic channel, but I did buy the book. And it is astonishing. The gospel itself is, from what I read, is fairly complete, though there are some missing sections because the condition of the manuscript itself, the original papyrus. Looking at it, they have a picture of it. You wonder how they even could separate the pages and make the translation. It just astonishes me that anybody could do that. The Gospel of Judas itself is sort of like The Little Prince. In one way is that Christ wants to get rid of his earthly body so that he can go back to his to heaven, which is Barbello. And like The Little Prince, who sheds his body by poisoning himself, getting bitten by the snake, so his real body can travel to his home planet. Judas is not the evil one and betrayer, but actually is the one apostle who knows who Christ is. And he knows Christ in terms of sort of a Gnostic universe, where he says, you're from Barbello, and Barbello is a place in the in Gnosticism, Gnostic thought. So, it's different from what received wisdom has it that Christianity is, or what the canon has become. Though I still believe that these thoughts, these ideas of Gnosticism exist even in the Gospels that are considered, you know, the only true Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And in the Bible itself, I think these ideas are still there, because I had, as a child, had sort of these Gnostic thoughts about Christ. I never thought of him as being God. And also, I guess I don't believe in faith, just on, you know, purely faith terms, you know. Believe in intuition. I think I said God talks to us, and I believe that. Now, okay, where am I here? Because this is important. So, okay, one thing is the Gospel of Judas. Pick it up, read it. It's exciting. The Gospel itself is, you know, 47 pages or something like that, less than that, because it's a lot of its footnotes. But then in the back, there are essays about what it means, the story of the manuscripts. It's exciting. And it made me cry when I read the beginning. I can't find the passage, but it was just so wonderful. Judas was not the betrayer, but actually was asked to do this so Jesus could shed his body to return to heaven. And one difference is that salvation is not, in this Gnostic universe, right? Salvation isn't the crucifixion that he died for our sins. It is that there are people who have a divine spark in them. not everybody has a divine spark in them, according to this Gnostic universe. And when they die, their spark goes back up into heaven. And the Gnosis, or knowledge, is what is revealed to these people internally, that they do have this divine spark. It's knowledge that they have a divine spark in them, that they will survive, that their true selves is this divine spark and not their earthly flesh. And the others, they just are like, you know, they have no souls, really. So according to the Gnostics, there are people walking around with no souls. I think they're the fundamentalists, because they have no other way of knowing anything. So they need to make up these stories and make it sound like law, whereas the Gnostic people have a sense of right and wrong because they know. Because they're part of a higher place. But anyway, so I want to read about Gnosticism. I don't think I'm a Gnostic. I don't think I have I don't necessarily believe in that paradigm. Okay, Gnosis in general. Although Gnosis is usually thought of, and I'm getting this from www.keper.net, topics Gnosticism, intro, HTM. So KHEPER.net. Okay, although Gnosis is usually thought of as an aspect of religion, it in fact differs from religion or faith in one extremely important respect. With religion, knowledge of higher things is not realized intuitively, but rather enforced as a body of knowledge, a dogma, a revelation, imposed from without. For example, the Bible, the Quran, the Gita. In the more extreme forms of religion, the so-called fundamentalist tendency, the believer is expected to accept the revelation without question. With Gnosis, one may indeed be inspired or stimulated by external teachings and revelations, but the essential knowledge comes from within. What this means basically is that there are as many Gnostic teachings as there are Gnostics, and vice versa. A modern-day Gnostic may be, and in fact usually is, a part of some tradition, Sufi, Kabbalistic, Tantric, Christian, but he, she will always interpret that tradition in an individual way. So, you know, I guess I am a sort of a Gnostic. I guess I'm a Gnostic. So I'm a Unitarian with a tad of Lutheran, and with a giant helping of Gnosticism. How's that? I guess that's what I believe. Oh, I told you what I believe. And that's the definition of it. I do believe it comes from within. I don't believe it's exact. It's never always external. If one could sum up the differences between Western materialism, religion, and Gnosticism, and also Eastern religion and philosophy, one could say that the Western position is more concerned with the manifest, with the creation, nature, and ultimate purpose of the cosmos and of man-woman. This is both in the case of exoteric and conventional religion, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Baha'ism, and the secular religion of Marxism. The esoteric Gnosis, or Gnosis, Gnosticism, Neoplatonism, Manichaeism, Ishrakism, Sufism, Kabbalah, Theosophy, and Anthroposophy. In contrast, the Eastern position is more concerned with the unmanifest, with the transcendent, and how to attain it. Of course, putting things simply in this way is to be guilty of gross overgeneralization, and I would add that there are very many exceptions to the rule on both sides. You know, in the 19th century, there was transcendentalism, a transcendental movement, which I believe was Thoreau. What else did they say? Okay, somebody also compared that to Rousseau. So I think even starting from the 18th century up to the 19th century, there was a shift away from faith. And by the end of the 19th century, we had all these different types of movements, like the Theosophy and... Well, in New England, there was the American Transcendentalism, Intellectualism, and that was the rise of Unitarianism, was in the 19th century, and Unitarian Universalist. And then this went around fine, and then we had the Depression in the 20s, the stock market, and I think that's when the fundamentalists started taking hold again, because America had a great deal of tragedy. Not only was the economy in ruins, basically, but in the 30s, and also there was the rise of communism and Marxism and all these things, right? And in the Midwest, we had the Dust Bowls in the 30s, and so people were poor and destitute. You know, the 30s was the Depression was a terrible time. And so I guess it was comforting that, you know, you had these fundamentalists, these preachers, who gave these people a sense of security in knowing. Now, and I think that's really important for people. You have to have a sense. You have to have a sense. You have to be able to center yourself. You have to have a rock to be on. In the case of the fundamentalists, the rock was Jesus, was God, and I think they perverted the word of God in many ways. That's my opinion, and I'm sticking to it, just because of the way that they focus on prophecy and focus on the end times and how they justify it with the Bible. How they'll take a little bit out of here, a little bit out of there. Listening to Jan Markell's show, Understanding the Times, when she talks about the end times, she'll say something about what's going on, and she'll pull something out of Ezekiel or out of Daniel, the Old Testament, New Testament. It does not make a difference. It's not just revelations at the end of the New Testament that they use as understanding the end of time, but they believe that Christ was around even when Moses was around, so that Christ was doing all this stuff back then. And so that just bothers me, because Christ was not born then, he wasn't around then, and God was, perhaps, yeah, but not Christ. And as we said before, what my belief is that Christ is the Son of God. And that's it. And whether he was it's hard to determine. I just don't believe I don't believe. I think that his crucifixion was terrible. A terrible thing. If it represents anything, I think what Christ is, what the lesson is that there is no need to have sacrifices, that because he was the final sacrifice. I was talking to a fellow workmate the other day who's very religious, who's a fundamentalist. And I said, you know, I think that Christ's crucifixion represents the end of sacrifice. Meaning that in the past, if you had a sin, you had to sacrifice a goat or a sheep, or you had to do something to rid you of your sin. And Christ said, you don't need to sacrifice sheep. You know, you just have to, you know, your sins can be erased. But you have to, what you have to do is you have to use your, you have to allow, I guess, you know, I don't know. I don't know the terms, but I don't want to sound religious, because it's not to be religious, because everybody has their own experience. But I believe that humans are able to know right and wrong, are able to receive this God wisdom, I'll call it. And that's the message, you know, is that we all are sons of God. And there is the rub, you know. Whereas these fundamentalists believe something entirely different from that. And maybe, I don't think I'm wrong. I know I'm not wrong. And you know, maybe that sounds conceited or what, but I just know in my heart of hearts. And this is not faith, it's a knowledge. I just know in my heart. It's something that doesn't need to be scientifically proven. I just know this in my heart. It's an intuition. They would, if they heard me, if I was to be in dialogue with them, they would not recognize that. They would think it's some devil or something. So with a fundamentalist, you can't, you see, with a fundamentalist, they're so focused on what is, what they believe is right, that they'll go to no ends to make it so. You can't change their mind. And I guess, you know, I'm just as steadfast because you're not going to change my mind either. But you know what? I am willing to listen. I'm willing to find out and learn how they, how people think or how other people think. On the other hand, they would be willing to hang me or burn me or stone me, as we have seen through the Catholic Church during the Reign of Terror or whatever it is. And in that, I mean, I may change my mind, but they would never allow themselves to learn anything other than what they believe. And they call that, you know, this faith. That's why I think they're kind of dangerous in the political realm, because who knows where they'll end. They have no concern. Some, and it's not all Christians, okay? And it's not all fundamentalist Christians, but there is a group of people who are Christians that really don't care about the earth. They just care about the end times. I don't know why they care so much about what I'm doing, you know, or whatever. So anyway, happy Easter.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and for you. And I think to myself, it's a wonderful world. I see skies of blue, clouds of white, the bright blessed days and the dark sacred nights. And I think to myself, it's a wonderful world. And the colors of the rainbow are so bright up in the sky, are also on the faces of people passing by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry and watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, it's a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, it's a wonderful world.
Resurrection. Well, it's Easter, and resurrection would be a great topic for Easter, since it is apparently the day that Christ rose. Let's see here. Yeah, he rose from the dead. He got out of the tomb, and he left Earth, though I think he visited a few people in between that time. At least that's what has been written. So anyway, in Wikipedia, the term resurrection is used in the literal sense to mean either the religious concept of the reunion of the spirit and the body of a dead person, or the return to life of a dead person. It is used in a figurative sense about broken or discontinued things which were never alive, but which have been restored to the functional state. For example, a company which has failed but is reopened by a new owner, resurrected. Rebirth is a different but analogous religious concept. The word resuscitation is used for return to life after clinical death by medical procedures. When I think of resurrection, I think of, you know, in the biblical term, where Jesus resurrected. And I also think of zombies, because they are dead and now they are alive. Of course, they're flesh-eating creatures. When I was a kid, I think I've said this before, I was five, six, and my parents used to take us to the drive-in movies a lot. And at the drive-in movies, I mean, rarely was there anything of very good at the drive-in movies, let's face it, you know. It was a lot of horror movies. They liked horror movies. And so they took us along. And one, I mean, it was like I was six or whatever, five or six, and we went to go see The Night of the Living Dead. It made an impression upon me. I remember it clearly. And it was just made me love horror movies. It scared the bejesus out of me. And I had nightmares ever since. Well, actually, I haven't had. I shouldn't say ever since because I don't have nightmares now. But as a child, I would have recurring nightmares of zombies just taking over the world and coming to our house. And we were forced to go into the basement. And the zombies were trying to break down the door. The choice was either to kill ourselves or let the zombies eat us. And I'd wake up in this cold sweat at this, you know, at this thought of having to make those decisions and how awful it was. But I don't have those dreams anymore. Ooh, I'm sorry, I'm yawning. We just got back from eating at John's sister's house. Her family, we had the Easter dinner, and I made chicken croquettes, and she made ham, and Gilly, John's mother, brought this lemon something, and she also brought asparagus. It was delicious. So I'm a little tired. But I wanted to talk about resurrection and zombies. I mean, when you think about it, Christianity and zombies sort of go hand in hand, because what is the Last Supper, I mean, Easter and zombies, okay? Yeah, the Last Supper, you have, this is my body, this is the bread, this is my body, eat it, this is my blood, drink it. And of course, you do that every time you take communion, and if you're Catholic, it actually turns into the body and blood of Christ. I think it's called transubstantiation. But here we are, flesh-eating cannibals. I mean, no wonder, you know, primitive societies looked at the Western conquerors as kind of odd. However, I mean, there were some cultures which really did eat their relatives, believing that it kept them close by. I guess so. Close in your gut, right? Working right through your system. Oh, Aunt Carol's tasted so good with a little bit of cinnamon. But resurrection, the idea has shown up in various ways. Rebirth, I think that's referring to reincarnation. And I think it is believed that at the end of time, Christians will be resurrected from their tombs and taken to heaven and judged. And I think that's the simple story. But there is more complex stories to end times. If you listen to these Christian radios, like stations like Jen Markell's station, you get these really complicated scenarios of what the end of time is like, and they're just so detailed, and I won't go into it any further, but it's like those books Left Behind. I mean, they're making a mint off of those books, trying to tell the story. Now, in the Old Testament, apparently, there have been several people who have raised people from death. Elijah did. Elisha did. Let's see here. There are some people who never experienced death, like Elijah. And Ezekiel did something here. I'm trying to read this as I talk. Vision of a valley of dry bones being restored as a living army. A metaphorical prophecy. Oh, yeah. I'd like to know from any of my listeners, what are the prophetic books of the Bible? Which of those are the prophecy books? Because these Christian people I was talking about, these fundamentalists who believe in the end times, they keep on talking about the prophetic part of the Bible. Now, they think the whole Bible is prophetic and therefore can be used in piecemeal fashion like a quilt to put together their story. Sort of what like lawyers do when they're trying to prosecute and defend is basically you take evidence and you piece it together to form a story. And one of the stories is going to be either sound more true to the jury or not. So it's, you know, that's really what they're doing. It has nothing to do with the truth. I mean, somebody may be on trial for murder. They may not have murdered that person, but the evidence can point to that person as being the murderer. And, of course, there's the prejudice of the jury, which I'm sure prosecutors and defense attorneys use to their benefit, or to their benefit, but to society's loss when they're doing this. So it's sad, because one thing is, I mean, is reason why there's more black and Hispanic people in prison than white people, and, you know, the truth of the matter is a lot of people who just believe that, you know, if the kid looks like a gangbanger and, you know, and he's being accused of doing some gangbanging thing, then they're going to be, they're going to be made guilty, basically. The story just has to sound right enough for them, you know? And that's what it is. It's all about the story. And that's what these, you know, Christian these people do. They like the story. They gather evidence, their evidence of different passages in the Bible. So they might take a little section of Daniel and a little section of Mark and a little section of Philippians and a little section of whatever and piece it together. And, you know, if you find enough of them, you're going to be able to explain everything that happens in the world. Of course, as they're always saying, they do say, well, we don't know because God doesn't tell us, which is right. God, you know, if God's going to do it, he's going to do it. He's not going to tell anybody. But they seem fit to use this as some sort of, I don't know, like a holier than thou or we know more than you sort of attitude. Push it in our face, which annoys me. As y'all know, it annoys me. It annoys me. Okay, kids, let's play some biblical stories here today. We'll put together passages and make a prophecy. How's that? What should we prophesy about today? Perhaps the end of the world? Well, I don't have a Bible with me, but maybe I'll do that. I'll just pick out random passages of the Bible and make prophecies. That will be part of the podcast. I'll prophesy anything you like. Like, perhaps, what kind of toothpaste you like, or what kind of, oh, I don't know, what kind of, ooh, listen to that. I keep on repeating myself, but at least it's not dead air. And what kind of ice cream you like, perhaps? Okay, so, what bist du? Okay, so, this brings me to, I have little notes here, can you believe it? The resurrection, zombies. Zombies is sort of like the science fiction version of resurrection. It's like, what if there's resurrection, but this is what actually comes out of the earth? Zombies. I love zombie movies. I've already mentioned that. Yeah, the most depressing zombie movie is Dawn of the Dead, the original Dawn of the Dead, because it's just like they all sort of die at the end of the movie. The remake is just as depressing. So, okay, my idea, what I believe, is that we don't die. Is that at the time of death, or supposed death, it's not that we go to heaven or someplace else. It's just that, like, we close our eyes and we die in one reality. And when we open our eyes, we're in another probable reality. So that we're dying all the time. I can think of times in my life where I probably should have died. For example, there was a time where I almost got hit by, like, a semi-truck. I was driving. It was rainy. And I heard this honk. And the thing sped by, and you know what? I could have died. That could have been a probable reality. I died, and I came into this reality. Of course, the same people can be in your reality. So, you know, your mother, your father, people around. It's not like you go to another another level. It's very mundane, you know. So you never know, you know. We should go on living forever and ever, and we're not really going to know until time goes by, basically. Or maybe what happens is that we're made to be forgetful at a certain time, so it just repeats and repeats and repeats in this sort of I'm not going to say vicious circle because that's coloring it, but you know, maybe that's what reincarnation is. Well, actually, my belief of reincarnation is that it is okay. What I think our soul is, I think our soul is many fingered, so to speak, so that my soul, like, look at your hand, okay? The thumb is me right now, okay? And the index finger is another part of my personality living in another time, because I believe all time is simultaneous. And the index finger, I already said the index finger, the middle finger, the next finger, the ring finger, the pinky, they're all different personalities, right? But the hand is the soul that communicates. So the thumb believes it had a reincarnation. It reincarnated from, let's say, a painter in the 15th century or whatever, a plowboy. That is another aspect of the personality. It's my personality I'm focused in right now, not remembering, but, you know, actually experiencing what is actually happening in another alternate probable universe, or I don't know if the probable is the right word, but like a parallel universe. And so time begins all at once. Now, this is not my original thought. This is something that has been written by Jane Roberts in her Seth books, The Nature of Personal Reality. But I do believe that. And I think I talked about my grandfather when he died, and I looked at him, and he just didn't look the same. And I think that body was just residue. The body was residue, and he was somewhere else. You know, he's in an alternate reality. He could even be in this reality as a reincarnation of himself. Because I believe you can reincarnate into the past or the future. It's wherever you're focused. So wherever he is focused is certainly not in my reality that I know of. I don't think he is, though. I think when you see people die, they're focusing somewhere else. And they're maybe with a probable reality of you. So if you were man and wife and the wife dies, right, and she's refocused somewhere else, her husband might be you, but a probable version of you. Or whatever. It's a little complicated, but that's what I believe. So I think that's all about resurrection. That's all for resurrection. You've been listening to The Flayed Show. You can reach me at 206-339-JOSE, or you can reach me at kenty@theflatedshow.com. Thank you for listening.